DW Deutsche Welle. World Link.
Welcome to DW's World Link, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. I'm Neil King in Bonn, Germany. On this week's programme, how anger and despair are mounting among the persecuted Rohingya community. How a refugee marathon in Israel is throwing the spotlight on something the Israeli authorities would rather be kept quiet. And how the culinary heritage of the destroyed Syrian town of Aleppo lives on in a small restaurant in the Norwegian capital of Oslo.
Syrian food is absolutely amazing. And I was thinking, you know, that you can't really get it anywhere. And then I thought, you know, there are so many people coming now that know how to cook. Why shouldn't they be given a chance to actually do what they know?
All that coming up on WorldLink. You're listening to DW's World Link with me, Neil King. This week, an extra $200 million were pledged at a UN-backed conference in Geneva to help address the humanitarian crisis the Rohingya are facing in Myanmar and neighbouring countries. Since late August, over 600,000 refugees from this persecuted Muslim minority have fled their homes in Myanmar, making this the fastest-growing refugee emergency in the world today. We've reported on the crisis previously on WorldLink, and this time we want to take a look at how the Rohingya, who are safely established outside of Myanmar, view the situation. In the Pakistani city of Karachi, there has been a Rohingya migrant community since 1960, and the recent wave of violence in Myanmar is reviving bad memories among the older generation and fueling anger among the young. Mudassa Shah's report is presented by Emma Wallace.
Habib ur-Rahman is 72. He's sitting inside his small house. He was born in Rakhine State in Myanmar and came to Pakistan in 1971, but he remembers his homeland like it was yesterday.
The complete journey from my home in Rakhine to Pakistan is still fresh in my mind. I also remember and recall watching movies in the cinema there when I closed my eyes. I've watched movies in the cinema in Yangon too.
Many families here still have relatives in Rakhine, where the Myanmar government has been carrying out raids since August. Rahman is worried for the safety of his own family members too. He weeps when he is alone in the house because he doesn't want his children to see him weeping and start feeling sad too.
I don't have any contact with my sister and brother in Myanmar. I don't have a cell phone, therefore I can only rely on what my neighbors have told me. Someone said they thought my brother and sister had left Myanmar and made it to Bangladesh. But some of my relatives have been killed in Myanmar. I can't see them as a government, just as a cruel state.
The Pakistani government has criticized the Myanmar government for its offensive, but so far its actions have stopped there. Many of the Rohingya in Pakistan don't have official permits, despite contributing to the economy through their fishing activities. The only way for many Rohingya to get identity cards in Pakistan is to first declare themselves as Bangladeshis and then claim a Pakistani registration with their Bangladeshi status, which is easier. That is what 21-year-old Arman Fida hopes to do, but it's difficult, he explains.
The officials demand $400 for a national identity card. I earn $250 a month, so how can I pay them that much amount? It would take me 6 or 7 months to pay the loan I'd borrowed from someone. It's a difficult deal for a poor person like me.
Amongst the young Rohingyas, there is growing dissatisfaction with the Pakistani authorities. Wali Muhammad is 21. He has been unemployed for the last few months. He meets up with other jobless friends in the evenings.
I left school when I was 15 to support the family. The only option open to me was to go to the sea to fish. But now the coast guards check identity cards, which we don't have. So I've been deprived of my livelihood. Lots of us don't have access to the same facilities which Pakistanis have.
One of Wali's friends turns on a video on his cell phone.
I weep for a long time when I watch these kinds of videos of what is going on in Rakhine province. One which stuck in my mind was of a girl who was stripped naked and then raped by 10 to 15 people. Later, she was tied up with rope and burnt alive.
Because of the problem with getting identity cards, most members of the Rohingya community have remained poor. Even when they have a job, they are only entitled to half the daily wages Pakistanis can expect because of their lack of a legal work permit.
We, the Rohingya, are being killed by Buddhists there in Myanmar, whereas Pakistanis kill us daily here in Pakistan. The Buddhists kill us once by shedding our blood, whereas Pakistanis kill us in installments, bit by bit. This is the only difference.
It is midnight in Arkan Abad colony, but the jobless young men are still awake and angry. One of Wali's friends starts singing a song, inciting other young men to take up arms. The song says that young Rohingya men should go to Rakhine in Myanmar for jihad, and with the mercy of God, they should take revenge for their relatives. The song declares, "We, the young Rohingya, will take back our land and rule there once again." So far, the Pakistani authorities have not acknowledged this growing dissatisfaction. The danger now is that other radical groups will capitalize upon the young men's anger and recruit them to fight jihad around the world. The Rohingya community in Pakistan may not be its largest minority group, but their anger, stoked up by watching brutal videos, is a ticking time bomb, which could explode at any time.
That report by Mudassar Shah was presented by Emma Wallace. The Israelis know better than most what it means to be a refugee. After all, the Jews were persecuted throughout history, culminating in the horrors of the Holocaust that very nearly saw the complete annihilation of Europe's Jewish population by Nazi Germany and its collaborators. The State of Israel is the safe haven the Jews have always wanted, and today they're also providing shelter for non-Jewish refugees. But some feel these new arrivals are not being treated fairly by Israeli authorities. Which brings us to our next story. In Tel Aviv, a mixed team of asylum seekers and Israelis has been training for weeks to participate in the Tel Aviv Night Run on October 31st. The Israeli organization called Hotline for Refugees and Migrants organized the team as a way to show support for a community of Africans who are struggling to see their rights recognized in Israel. Federica Sasso has the story.
It's already dark, and the Tel Aviv seaside promenade is busy with runners training in small groups.
Two people, pair. Can you see me, guys?
Guys, line up in pairs.
Under a couple of decorative palm trees, a mixed group of Israelis and asylum seekers from Sudan and Eritrea are warming up before their 10K jog. They are all wearing brand new t-shirts that read "Together with Refugees" in English, Hebrew, Arabic and Tigrinya. The group has come together thanks to the Hotline for Refugees and Migrants, an NGO that for the past two decades has been fighting to ensure the rights of refugees and migrant workers in Israel. The Tel Aviv Night Run, for which the assembled men and women are training, will take place next week, on October 31st. The idea behind creating the group was to show support for the disenfranchised community of African migrants living in Israel. Experienced runners and complete novices heeded the call, and for the past 8 weeks have been running once a week under the guidance of that man you hear in the background, Osman Ali, an asylum seeker from Darfur.
great victory that you did today, like 10 kilometers. And I'm really proud of you guys. Let us say thank you very much for everybody.
After practice, the group rests on the grass behind the promenade. Airplanes and bats fly above our heads, while Ali shares his experience of fleeing Darfur, arriving in Egypt, and eventually crossing the Sinai Desert and stealing across the border into Israel.
It was really horrible. There is no way out. It was really messy. You can't stay in Egypt, you can't go to Libya, you can't go back to Sudan.
Ali arrived here in 2012, one of the tens of thousands of asylum seekers who have done the same in the last 10 years.
In 2007, it was the Gaddafi-Berlusconi agreement that made people give up trying to get to Europe and come to Israel.
That's Sigal Rosen. She's the Public Policy Department Director at the Hotline for Refugees and Migrants, and one of the founders of the organization. The agreement she mentions, signed by the former leaders of Italy and Libya, included cooperation between the two countries in the fight against illegal immigration towards Europe. It provided the basis for joint maritime patrols and allowed Italy to send migrants back to Libya.
Since 2007, we see a rise until 2011, when it was more than 1,000 people entering every month. In 2012, three things happened at the same time. Israel built a fence on the Egyptian border. The Human Rights Court found the Gaddafi-Berlusconi agreement to be illegal and abrogated it. The third thing was that Israel legislated the anti-infiltration law that made it possible to detain asylum seekers that enter through the Egyptian border for an unlimited amount of time. I believe that it's the combination that made people stop coming here.
Today, by most estimates, there are about 38,000 asylum seekers in Israel. The majority of them are from Sudan and Eritrea, where they fled brutal regimes, violence, and hunger. Israel was one of the first countries to sign the Refugee Convention of 1951, but so far it has accepted less than 1% of the requests to grant refugee status. Instead, the government issues short-term visas that allow asylum seekers to remain in the country, but keep them in a legal limbo, delaying or denying the recognition of the refugee status.
We used to have 64,000 Africans here. We now have 38,000 because we manage, by all sorts of decrees, deport so many of them.
The Israeli government has repeatedly portrayed asylum seekers as infiltrators looking for work, rather than people whose lives are in danger in their own countries. Subsequently, the government enacted a series of legal measures aimed at pressuring asylum seekers to accept what is known as voluntary departures to two supposedly undisclosed countries.
Since 2013, the Israeli government offers Sudanese and Eritreans who cannot go back to their country because they are real refugees a possibility to go to Rwanda and Uganda. Israel do not reveal the name of the countries, and it claims that the agreement with the countries are secret. But we know that these countries are Rwanda and Uganda because we have so many friends who went and called us from these countries.
Ali and many other asylum seekers I spoke to have decided, despite the difficulties, to stay. They speak Hebrew fluently and have a job. And even though often asylum seekers live in crowded apartments in impoverished neighborhoods, they can find housing and sign leases. The African community also enjoys Israel's freedom of speech and organized massive protests demanding the expansion of migrants' rights. Unfortunately, the rallies didn't lead to any real change. Even Ali's hobby, running, is complicated because of his status.
I was prohibited to go for 42 kilometers, like full marathon. I mean, the reason behind that, they said, no, you're an asylum seeker, you're not Israeli citizen. But I ran up to 21 kilometers and I took the first place, the second place, the third place every time.
Running as a group on October 31st will be another chance to show that Israelis and refugees can, despite everything, come together.
Ido, I live in Jaffa, and I thought it was a really good idea. Just get to know the people behind the headlines, you know, read about them all the time. We're like
we're exposed to this kind of a framing of the media. We all talk about the same thing, but nobody really knows who are these people, what do they want, what's their story.
My name is Afwerki Tahame. I'm from Eritrea. I'm in Israel. I've been 9 years, almost 10 years. I'm trying to come as a refugee to join this run and to tell Israel people there are refugees here and they need to know and to give them their rights, the government especially.
If we want to stay in the family of democratic nations, then we have to take our share. This is like a legal obligation that we took upon ourselves when we signed the convention. I am ignoring now the moral aspects of it, the fact that Israel was established by refugees and for refugees and that we initiated the convention. Just by the international law, we have to check the asylum request of these people and to grant asylum to those who deserve it. And right now, we don't do it. It's very problematic.
I'm Federica Sasso for DW in Tel Aviv.
Refugees also play a very active role in our next story. Refugees from Aleppo in Syria, to be precise. Years of conflict has reduced Aleppo to a shell of what it once was. Before the civil war, it was the country's largest city. Its location on very fertile land along the Silk Road made it into a culinary capital of the Middle East. Now, along with its people and infrastructure, much of that tradition is gone. Yet in remote Norway, a small piece of Aleppo's culinary heritage lives on, thanks to a local charity helping Syrian refugees find work. Lars Bavanger reports from Oslo.
Vippa Food Hall is Oslo's newest gourmet mecca, housed in a huge disused harbour shed. In the centre, a communal eating area with long wooden tables and benches. Lining the walls, converted shipping containers offering up food from around the world. The smell of lamb and cumin is wafting in from one corner of the hall. The sign above the counter reads Aleppo Bahebek, Arabic for Aleppo, I love you. It serves Syrian food and is run by Syrian refugees.
اسمي محمد نور حاضري وجيت للنرويج ب 19/10/2015.
Muhammad Hadri is one of more than 10,000 Syrians who've come to Norway since the war started in 2011. He arrived in October 2015 after fleeing from Aleppo, having to leave the rest of his family behind.
I كنت عايش في موتاك بيصير بمنطقة اسمها سوندير.
Muhammad first spent time in a refugee camp at the end of a fjord in a tiny Norwegian town far north of Oslo. After securing a work permit, he came to the capital to find a job. That's when he found the Vippa Food Hall, and that is also when he met Ragnhild.
My name is Ragnhild Slettner, and I am the founder and the daily leader of the coping guide in Norwegian called Mestringsguiden. But we try to help refugees in those early stages of being settled after they get their residence permit. So they've been like maybe two years in reception centers just waiting. And I've seen so many people coming that have, you know, amazing skills. They have skills from their former life and from wherever they came from that has been sort of totally neglected. So this is really something I want to help people not only cope, but actually master their lives again as they used to before they had to flee.
So tell me how you came up with the idea for Aleppo Bahebek here in Vippa in Oslo.
I started my work as a volunteer in the reception center in the autumn of 2015. And all the people that I helped, whatever it was, they invited me for dinner. And Syrian food is absolutely amazing. And I was thinking, you know, that you can't really get it anywhere, apart from in people's homes. And then I thought, you know, there are so many people coming now that know how to cook. Why shouldn't they be given a chance to actually do what they know?
By chance, the Vipa food hall was just about to open, and Ragnhild approached them with her idea of a Syrian kitchen run by refugees. They accepted right away.
From then on, we had 6 weeks until we opened, and in 6 weeks, we did everything. I had lots of people helping, volunteering. I already had the chef that had contacted me who said, you know, I live in the reception center. Could you help me to find housing? I am a chef. I need to work. I was like, that's perfect. You know, I'm opening a Syrian food stall. Welcome. So it all sort of came together in a miraculously way.
Mulukiyet means from King Malik Mulukiyet, King.
Chef Mohammed Hadri is one of around 10 Syrian refugees who work at Aleppo Bahebek. His colleague, Yakin Al-Balki, is from Damascus and helps translate.
How important is it for you to have a job as a refugee in Norway?
It's important for me because I like to work, I like to be active. When I was in a camp, I was just sitting and waiting and doing nothing. That's why I want to be as a normal one, to work or to be active in this life.
When you are in the camp, what is it like to just wait and do nothing?
It was awful because I was waiting for unknown future. He said that I can't describe it in the right way, but it was awful.
How does it feel to be able to work in a Syrian restaurant? Is it nice to be able to make the food you had from home?
It's nice to make your own food or your food from your country. And he likes to this for this food to be accepted by Norwegian society. So the Norwegian like it.
We're now in the back. As you can see, it's very much container-like, and it's not a very big kitchen. I think it's 7 square meters. Mm-hmm. We produce everything from, you know, from chopping all the fresh vegetables, from cooking the aubergine every day. So we have a very big production of many different dishes that comes into one.
It smells absolutely wonderful here as well.
Yeah.
How's the business? I mean, people seem to have taken to the Syrian food.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it is very good food. And the thing is, Norwegians are not spoiled with good shawarma. We fill the gap because since the opening, we've had, you know, great success. I didn't think about that when I started. I was all about thinking about the, you know, the work, the yes, we need to get people to work. I'm not so interested in money. So when I sort of opened this, I thought maybe that I had to apply for some funding from the municipality, you know, to get some project funding from different places. But thankfully, we don't need that because this food sells.
Not all the Syrians working in the kitchen are trained chefs. The restaurant is not meant to be a permanent stop for them, but an important stepping stone into the Norwegian labour market. Yakin Al-Balki wants to teach.
To be honest, I'm looking for to be a math teacher because I am a math teacher in Syria. But if I found myself in a restaurant, maybe I will go up in the system. Yes, maybe I'll change.
Blanche Bevanger, DW, Oslo.
And just a reminder, you're listening to DW's World Link with me, Neil King. Stay tuned for more personal stories. We'll be right back. You're listening to DW's World Link, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. I'm Neil King. Coming up in the second half of the programme, we hear how a Polish journalist is uncovering some uncomfortable truths about his country's and his own family's role during the occupation by Nazi Germany. Plus, the Buddhist nun from South Korea, who's shot to fame worldwide for her temple cuisine.
Humans are like seeds. You plant a seed in the soil and it grows out of it. I can be a cucumber, I can be cabbage. When I cook, I become that ingredient.
All that and more coming up on WorldLink. A new book published in Poland examines a topic rarely discussed so far. To what extent Polish police, acting under Nazi orders during World War II, willingly collaborated with the occupiers. The author's great-uncle was executed by the resistance for being the leader of the Warsaw police force at the time. Under communism, he was branded a traitor, which is now contested by historians. But the author faces another problem. Poland's present nationalist rulers are trying to rewrite history to conform to an image of Poles always being the victims and heroic fighters against outside aggression. So, will the truth about moral dilemmas facing people during the war ever be told? From Warsaw, Julian Berner files this report.
Dziś do ciebie przyjść nie mogę. Zaraz idę w nocy mrok.
Resistance fighters, including former soldiers and policemen, sitting around the fire deep in the woods before setting out on another raid against the Nazis. That's the image most Poles have been brought up with about what life in occupied Poland was like. But journalist Maciej Bernat-Reszczyński knows from his family history that not all the choices Poles were forced to make can be painted in black and white. His great-uncle, Aleksander Reszczyński, was the Warsaw head of what was called the Blue Police. This force consisted of pre-war Polish policemen who chose to help police Nazi-occupied Poland. Many found Reszczyński's decision to accept the post offered by the Nazis dubious.
He was very strict. He believed above everything in discipline. And then came the war, and he wanted to still believe in discipline and still be a great patriot. And he was bound. You know, he was just heading for tragedy straight away. In Warsaw, there were 20,000 Polish soldiers who should have reported to German authorities as well. Nobody did. So why did he report? And this is where the story becomes personal, because he had a young daughter and a poetess wife. And I think he was absolutely horrified what will become of them should anything happen to him.
In his book, Maciej Reszczyński quotes former resistance members who admit that until his great-uncle was executed, he had done nothing questionable apart from joining the force. He wasn't the only one with this dilemma. Wojciech Szczepański is the son of a pre-war policeman who was forced to wear the blue uniform because otherwise he would face a death sentence.
When the war broke out, my dad was hiding in the woods. The Gestapo sniffed him out. They came and told my mother that unless he reported for duty, the whole family would be shot. So my dad went to the Gestapo headquarters and he was ordered to join a blue police unit.
According to historians, a number of blue policemen actively worked for the resistance, warning it of planned Nazi reprisals against the civilian population. Many of those who were found out were executed, and in this cemetery in a village east of Warsaw, two of them are buried. But this cemetery also holds a darker secret. Krystyna Gil comes from a Roma family who, like local Jews, were targeted by the SS. She was the only one to escape from a massacre of Romani people in the village. Krystyna says some of the blue policemen who accompanied the Nazis willingly went along with them.
This grave contains the remains of my mother, brother and two-year-old sister. My mother and brother were shot, but my sister wasn't. The blue policeman didn't shoot such little children. He was saving his ammunition. He smashed their heads against the chapel over there, and he threw their bodies into a ditch. Then he sprinkled quicklime over them. It was a horrible sight.
Historian Adam Hempel, a consultant of the Institute of National Remembrance in Warsaw, studies the activities of the Blue Police. He's trying to establish the extent of their collaboration with the Nazis to decide what they were forced to do and where their actions went beyond that.
Polish police units were forced to take part in many Nazi acts of repression, like roadblocks, house searches, or guarding the bodies of those executed by the SS. But some of the police, including officers, willingly collaborated with the Germans. In some areas, special units would operate with assistance from Polish civil servants. They took part in massacres of civilians, mostly Jews.
Maciej Bernard Reszczyński first found out about his great uncle's past in his late teens. He heard his name mentioned at a rally organized by the Communist Youth Organization at a World War II anniversary ceremony in his school.
It was ironic and tragic, I suppose, that the first anniversary we were supposed to celebrate was the anniversary of the execution of my granduncle by the communist underground. He was unequivocally termed a traitor, a collaborator, and his execution was considered a great victory of the then very young communist underground. In what you would term today PR sense, that was a great victory indeed, because a commandant of Polish police in Warsaw in 1943, that was a big fish to have killed.
The man's wife and daughter went through hell from then on, trying to clear his name after the war. His daughter Hanka joined the anti-communist resistance at the age of 17. She was imprisoned and sentenced to death, but was then pardoned. His wife was hounded by the regime, and together with her daughter, she ended up in exile in the UK. In his book entitled The Inconvenient Pole, Maciej Bernard Reszczyński explains that while much of Polish society actively resisted the Nazis, there were also those like his great uncle who were stuck in morally grey areas. But such subtleties of history seem to be lost on Poland's present nationalist government. Critics say it is glorifying the past to suit political goals and build patriotism among the young. A number of productions like this series entitled The Time of Honor have been commissioned about brave Poles and bestial Germans. This coincides with mounting verbal attacks by Polish leaders on neighboring Germany, which they claim is trying to impose its will on countries like Poland. Maciej Bernard Reszczyński is appalled by what's happening.
We're talking not just about inconvenient Poles, but about inconvenient history. I think that we can clearly observe nowadays in Poland falsifying the past, rewriting it. But when it's history, you know, we only have the past today and tomorrow. These are the basic building blocks of our lives. So it makes me worried about the future.
Indeed, as inconvenient truths are swept under the carpet and the image of Polish history becomes confused in many young people's heads, there are also those who wonder what the long-term consequences will be. Also for those who are manipulating history right now. Julian Berner, DW, Warsaw.
Well, here in Germany, there are many who are not so much worried about history being rewritten, but rather about history repeating itself. The recent rise of the far-right populist party Alternative for Germany, which also harbours some neo-Nazis among its ranks, has led to much talk about the need to prevent history recurring again. And it comes at a time when the number of Jews in Berlin, be they observant or not, is growing. So how do we balance the past with the present? Our regular Worldlink columnist Tamsin Walker went to Berlin's old Jewish quarter to look for some answers.
When I flew back to Berlin this summer, I overheard a conversation between two girls from Tel Aviv. One, who'd never been here before, was asking the other, who's a resident, if she ever felt unsafe wearing her Star of David pendant in the city. The question surprised me, but not as much as the answer, which was a depressing shade of grey. I thought about those girls yesterday when I read an almost throwaway line about how Berlin has one of the fastest-growing Jewish communities anywhere. That, in turn, was an interesting claim in light of a recent report by the Körber Foundation, which revealed just 4 in 10 German children between the ages of 14 and 16 know that Auschwitz was a Nazi concentration camp. I find it almost impossible to understand how so many teenagers are unaware of a place which played such a defining part in their country's past. And where, as a Greek-Jewish prisoner wrote in a buried manuscript published for the first time in German this month, there was suffering the human mind cannot imagine. Even without a formal education on the evils of National Socialism, here in Berlin at least, the Holocaust is ever present. As I walked through the city centre this morning, I passed 2 wall plaques remembering the Jews deported to camps such as Auschwitz, 4 museums relating to the Holocaust, 3 of which I went into, 2 former Jewish orphanages, a Jewish cemetery, and 2 synagogues with round-the-clock police presence. There's no denying that here, history is on display. Less overtly evident, however, is the regrowth of Berlin's pre-1933 vibrant Jewish communities. But that doesn't mean it's not happening.
I don't think I know. You can see it. It's growing for sure. Definitely, yes.
A few doors down from the glittering golden dome of one of the aforementioned synagogues is a kosher restaurant called Hummus and Friends. Manager Malka is a Russian-speaking Jew who moved to Germany aged 14 and has spent the past decade in Berlin. She belongs to the Lauda Orthodox community, which is largely comprised, she says, of young families.
We had in the beginning, when I came, around 20 families. Now we have 90. So in the almost 10 years, I think it's a very big change.
There are other small groups too, and of course the largest and simply named Jüdische Gemeinde, or Jewish community, which was originally established in 1671, and whose members currently number around 10,000. Then there are the Israeli Jews, many of whom don't belong to any religious group, but who do belong to the city.
All the Israelis love Berlin. They're crazy about Berlin. Like, crazy, crazy. I think there's 2 reasons. One of the reasons, because it's very cheap compared to Israel. The second reason is the liberal, the open mind, to live the life the way you want it. We always say it's not even Germany. Berlin is Berlin. It's different. It's Berlin.
Yet even here, in this Berlin, in this liberal city in the heart of Europe, there are places Malka says she would not feel safe wearing her Jewishness openly. Places not far from where we met. Places where Jews were once rounded up for deportation to the concentration camp, which drew so many blanks among German teenagers. But for her, the answer is not so much in the past as in the present. And in building an awareness and an understanding of Judaism in the here and now. If that were achieved, perhaps conversations about the dangers of wearing a Star of David necklace in public could themselves become history.
Many thanks to our regular Worldlink columnist Tamsin Walker there. And just a reminder that you're listening to DW's Worldlink. I'm Neil King in Bonn, Germany. Time for a short music break before we visit a unique Buddhist nun in South Korea who is famous for her spiritual approach to cooking and was even featured in the Netflix series Chef's Table. So stay tuned. We now come to the South Korean Buddhist nun who is helping vegan temple cuisine go global. Her name is Young Kwan, and her recipes, as well as her culinary philosophy, have influenced chefs and foodies far away from her monastery. But this celebrity chef remains humble and is still connected to her spiritual roots. Reporter Jason Strother recently paid Young Kwan a visit at her mountainside temple, 270 kilometers south of Seoul.
It was raining when I arrived at the Baekyeongsa Temple in South Jeolla Province. There are several tile-roofed buildings here, including the Chunjingham Convent. That's where I met the venerable Jung Kwan in front of.
안녕하세요. 반갑습니다. 반갑습니다. 제이슨입니다.
Jung Kwan is tiny, and like all Buddhist monks or nuns, her head is shaved. Dressed in a gray robe, she looks grandmotherly, but she doesn't want to tell me how old she is. Age is just a number after all. She's lived at the temple since she was 17, but she's been cooking longer than that. Jung Kwan says she feels a spiritual connection with the food she prepares.
나는 내가 주체입니다. 내가 나 주체예요.
Humans are like seeds. You plant a seed in the soil and it grows out of it, just like the way we come from our mother's bodies. This is how we're all connected to the universe. Nature takes time to grow all things. I can be a cucumber, I can be cabbage. When I cook, I become that ingredient.
그러니까 인간과 식물은 함께 간다는 겁니다.
Jung Kwan speaks in mostly Buddhist spiritual terms. It's a little over my head. But this perspective on food and life is what's made her a celebrity philosopher chef. Earlier this year, Jung Kwan and her temple cuisine were featured in the Netflix documentary series The Chef's Table. Now food lovers from abroad come on pilgrimage to Baekyeongsa to learn from her. But Jung Kwan says the documentary and her new friendships with other celebrity chefs in New York and Paris haven't changed her. She's a monk first, chef second.
Bowing. Back up. Bowing down my knees, down to the ground. Leaning forward. Hands on the floor. Hands behind me.
Inside a sanctuary, Jung Kwan shows me how to pray in front of a large Buddha statue. Face to the ground. She says there's no difference to her between meditating here or cooking in the kitchen.
그냥 아무 생각 없이 들어가는 게 아닙니다. 공양간
들어. To me, cooking is like praying. When I enter the kitchen, I enter without thoughts. It's just like I'm bowing to Buddha. I concentrate only on myself and what I'm doing at that moment. I hope that those who eat what I've cooked feel happy and at peace.
가지고 들어갑니다. 어때? 들어가서
섞어줘야 돼. 한쪽으로 해서.
The kitchen is where Jung Kwan says she can best communicate with others. Standing in front of the stove, she's preparing seaweed soup. To her side are bowls of diced kimchi, persimmons, and noodles. All ingredients are grown on or nearby the temple grounds. Unlike a lot of Korean cuisine, which relies heavily on salt, pepper paste, and other sauces, Jung Kwan says she keeps her dishes simple.
사람도 너무 많은 이렇게 화장을 할 때 너무 많은 치장을 하면
It's like putting on too much makeup. You don't feel free. So when I cook, I avoid using too much sauce or marinade. I want to maximize the original taste of the ingredient. I seek the emotional flavor of a vegetable.
She says you need to taste the food with your entire body. But most people don't understand that what they put in their mouths affects them in ways they never expect.
쌀밥을 해서 그 당분에다가 같이 섞어서 우리랑 하고 삭혀놓으면 거기서 단맛이 자연 단맛이 나옵니다.
These days people eat too much fast food, especially those who live in cities. When you eat this kind of food, your mind also rushes. It makes you angry or violent. I think by eating slow food, It transforms you as well, but in a positive way.
And don't cook when you're angry either. Jung Kwan says it poisons the food and will make those who eat it angry too. Dinner is served. In addition to the soup and noodles are soybean stew, shiitake mushrooms, and multigrain rice. It's a feast and delicious, but Jung Kwan doesn't think it's anything special. She says food is just fuel for her meditation. She never actually craves anything.
All human beings have three desires: the desire to sleep, the desire to eat, and the desire to live for a long time. But if you can't relinquish these desires, then you'll never become free or enlightened. Giving up the desire to eat is the most difficult. I think if we could all end this desire, then we'd all feel more comfortable.
Giving up wanting food? I find that hard to swallow. I also can't believe she doesn't crave anything from outside the temple. So before I said goodbye to Jung Kwan, I had to ask her if she has any guilty pleasures. What she told me was, well, enlightening.
Well, sometimes, not too often, I enjoy ice cream or maybe chocolate, especially after I've been meditating all day. I feel ice cream really refreshes my body and energy.
Vanilla and green tea flavored ice cream to be exact, Jung Kwan tells me. Jason Struther, DW, South Jeolla Province.
Can't say I've ever had green tea ice cream. Anyway, our last story this week is about Sachi Noro, a Paris-based performer who started studying ballet at the age of six and went on to become a professional ballerina at the Deutsche Oper Berlin. Frustrated by the lack of space for personal creativity, she began training for the circus at the age of 26. She is now co-director of a circus school in Nanterre in France, as well as choreographing and performing contemporary dance. Her most unusual artistic venture to date combines her dance and circus training with her nomadic spirit and a strangely intense passion for shipping containers, as Danny Mitzman found out at a recent performance in northern Italy.
It reminds me of the tea house in Japan, with all the essential, this way of not having more than what I need, and also to think that it gives me an autonomy.
Sachi Noro has a passion for containers. She runs her circus school from one, has another one as an office, and says maybe one day she'll even go and live in one.
I spend time in my container. It's like a memory box. All my costume, most of my books are there, and it's kind of a retreat for me and a space for creation.
She found a kindred spirit in designer Sylvain Hall.
I live on a big shipping harbour, the big container terminal of Marseille, where the architecture beside my house is thousands of containers, so they are colours, mix of colours. It's really fantastic.
A symbol of globalization, when shipping containers are adapted for other uses, they're usually associated with negative situations like refugee camps and disaster zones. For Sachi and Sylvain, the challenge was to find the poetry and beauty in an object known for its cold functionality. Origami does just that. By cutting a triangular section of the metal and inserting a hand-cranked pulley system, Sylvain's transformed an 8-ton, 40-foot shipping container into a mesmerizing, gargantuan, shifting dance stage.
It's folding itself. It's like this container, which starts with like a container box, open itself and create empty space and creates height and creates shapes And it's very geometrical. She's dancing on something which is in permanent motion. So there's no horizontal, there's no vertical. What was vertical, 5 minutes later, is diagonal. So it's a bit different of classic dancing.
It's a dancing with a container, as a partner, a moving partner. All the time the space is changing and the balance of the body is changing too, and the direction are changing, and it's from 4 meter high to 8 meter high, so I can't do a wrong step and fall.
Barefoot and without a harness or a safety net, Saatchi admits rehearsals were pretty scary.
For 1 week I had this bit kind of nausea about working with it because I sort of accident. But the machine is secure and I know what I'm doing because I did it until having memorized into my body, so I could do it closed eyes.
Saatchi says her fascination with containers and inspiration for origami has a symbolic family connection. Brought up near Paris, she's half French, half Japanese. Her father was an Aikido master sent to teach the martial art in Europe. He arrived in Marseille on a freight boat from Yokohama.
And I thought of this idea because my father was very sick and couldn't go back to Japan, and it was very painful for him. So I wanted to do the way back for him. And if my father came with Aikido, I wanted to dance the way back to Japan and film it. And it's what I did. I left from Marseille, and then I arrived 42 days later in Japan, and I filmed all this journey dancing in the cargo. And it's where I start also to develop vocabulary with container. And a lot of movement inspiration came from that journey.
With the exception of strong winds, Saatchi performs in any weather conditions, unless, she says, it's too cold for her to feel her fingers and toes.
When we did it in the park of Chamarandes, it's in south of Paris, a beautiful place with trees, incredible centenary trees, and the people are used to watch shows inside this park. Started to rain, but rain like a crazy rain. And after 10 minutes, it never happened to me, but I thought, okay, now I'm going to stop the show. I hate to stop a show, and when it's raining, I don't care about the rain. But this time was so strong that I thought about it, but the public didn't move. They just stayed. Nobody moved, so I just kept going.
Since creating origami 5 years ago, they've staged performances in outdoor locations all over Europe, in parks, squares, seafronts and forests. This evening's venue is an Italian football field.
Thanks. So we're in the container now, we're actually inside. This is the bit that the public doesn't see but often wants to come and see afterwards. And it's also where Saatchi warms up.
All what is for the show is inside the container, which is one of the basic or original duty of a container is to carry. So we arrive and everything is there, the theater and the props, everything is there.
Sylvain says a new container costs 4,000 euros and the trailer it sits on a further 3,000. Origami cost a total of 20,000 euros to create, made possible thanks to funding from French dance houses and theatre companies. But origami hasn't only been staged in Europe. Saatchi's also performed it in Chile. When they heard about the theatre container festival in Valparaiso, Sylvain bought and transformed another container there. They now hope to take it to some of the most remote parts of South America.
Building this object in Chile, we thought about going to all the countryside where they don't have theatre, where they very rarely see shows or never see shows, and be able to just like stop by and open the origami and leave and go to another place.
And Sachi says she hopes to perform origami in Japan one day.
I hope we will go, but it's very difficult in Japan to present show outside. And it will take, I think, a little bit of time.
Did your dad ever see origami?
No, he died before. Yes, he saw the movie I made going from Marseille to Japan, but never saw origami. I think he will be very so scared. I think he will have closed his eyes himself most of the time.
Sachi's just completed her 100th performance of origami and says she has no plans to call it a day.
I was saying to my colleague that I wanted to do my 50 years on the origami, so it's in 7 years.
Danny Mitzman, DW Radio, Bassano del Grappa.
And that brings us to the end of this week's show. If you have any comments relating to the reports you've just heard, feel free to drop us a line at worldlink@dw.com or visit our Facebook page, DW Global Society. If you'd like to listen again, go to dw.com/worldlink, look up DW English on SoundCloud, or check us out on iTunes. This week's show was produced by me, Neil King, and Loveday Wright. Our sound engineer was Jürgen Kuhn. Bye for now. Hope you join us again next week. World Link was brought to you by DW in Bonn, Germany.